Welcome to Delmarva Public Radio's celebration of National Poetry Month. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This is the second in our series of four lectures on significant poetic themes. In the first talk, Ann Colwell, Associate Professor of English at the University of Delaware, spoke on the poetry of love. And we learn that love is the oldest theme in poetic literature. Today, our speaker is Adam Tavell, professor of English at Warwick Community College in Salisbury. Adam will explore the life and poetry of the great African-American poet Gwendolyn Brooks. Brooks was born in 1917, and even though she lived mostly in Chicago, she was still a child of the segregated era, and poverty was her namesake. At the same time, she was brilliant. As you will hear from Adam's talk, she published her first poem at the age of 13 and went on to publish more than 70 poems by the time she was 16. At 32, in 1950, she won the Pulitzer Prize. Gwendolyn Brooks was a poet of the unique struggles of African-American women, and in that work sought to define her own Black identity and the dignity she found in that experience. In Les Miserables, Victor Hugo said that there are no bad plants, nor are there bad people. There are only bad cultivators. Adam Tavell reminds us that in one of her poems, Gwendolyn Brooks says that we are each other's harvest. Through her poetry, she was a great cultivator of the human spirit. Is it any wonder that she served as Poet Laureate of Illinois for 32 years? Here is Adam Tavell and the life and poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Adam Tavell. I'm a professor of English here at Warwick Community College, and I'm really grateful that you've come out on a chilly February night to celebrate Gwendolyn Brooks, one of the most important American poets of the 20th century. We're here tonight in honor of Black History Month, something that we take very seriously and with great pride at the college. And before we jump in, I just want to thank two people for making this happen. Kamisha Handia, our Director of Student Engagement, and Hal Wilson from Delmarva Public Radio, both of whom have been great to work with. I called tonight's talk Delicious Agony because that was Gwendolyn Brooks's own phrase, or definition rather, for what poetry was, or maybe to say it better, a life in poetry. And I subtitled it An Appreciation of Gwendolyn Brooks, Social Poet. She preferred to be called a social poet rather than an activist poet or political poet, and perhaps I can explain why in a few minutes. Let me begin by making us all quite uncomfortable. I want to share with you some rather startling statistics about what it means to be a woman of color in the United States in the digital age. According to the global nonprofit Catalyst, women of color currently represent 39% of the US female population. By the year 2050, women of color will be the majority of women at 54%. But according to the US Department of Health and Human Services, only one in four African American women hold a college degree, at least as of 2014. And the Black median household income was one-third less than that of whites. And finally, according to the Center for American Progress, on average, African American women only earn 61 cents on the dollar compared with white men as of 2017. So if I am the manager of a bank in Salisbury, Maryland, I'm a white man, and a friend of mine who happens to be a woman of color who lives in, say, Cambridge, is also a manager of a bank. She's going to make 61 cents on my dollar. Something to think about. I've begun with these statistics and with this sort of raw look at injustice in America because we cannot really have a meaningful conversation about Gwendolyn Brooks as a human being or as a poet or as a citizen without really asking what it means to be a black woman in the United States. And so when we think about her and her legacy, there are three things I want to emphasize in tonight's talk and why she matters and why, hopefully, and this is my main objective, you rush out to read her later this evening and in the weeks to come and you find her work. First and foremost, Gwendolyn Brooks was a trailblazer. She was arguably, or perhaps inarguably, the most important black poet after World War II. And really, her shadow looms large on all poetry that's being published right now in the United States. She is a matriarch in our literature. She was also an activist, in many ways redefined what that meant in the literary arts. For a long time in this country, there was this notion that either you were a poet with a capital P and then perhaps you were involved in social causes on the side, or you were an activist and your writing grew out of some sort of quaint hobby. And Brooks proved that you could do both with equal mastery, that you could be a serious poet taken seriously by other serious poets and yet still call for serious change in your country. And finally, something I hope to emphasize near the end of my talk is that Brooks is quickly becoming a neglected master. When I was a high school student, she was a common name to encounter in a high school literature course. And certainly here at Warwick, I imagine many of you know her most famous poem. It's called We Real Cool. But we have in many ways diminished her and compartmentalized her and reduced her to that one highly anthologized poem. And I think that's a disservice to her and her legacy. And perhaps we can redeem that legacy tonight. One final thing I want to say before we jump in and really examine her experiences, her poetry, and her story. I'm a white man. I'm not really equipped to tell anybody's story other than my own. I've been a professor of English at Warwick for 15 years. I've written 3 books of poems. I'm talking about Brooks as a poet and as a reader, and really from that angle. I'm not a scholar. As Brooks herself once joked, I'm not a scholar. I'm just a writer who loves to write, will always write. And I feel a kind of kinship with that energy. I want to bring a kind of zealous passion for her ability to be a role model. But only her poems can tell their story. Gwendolyn Brooks was born in 1917. We just had a major motion picture called 1917. That is a gripping film about World War I. But before that film came out, I imagine if we asked the average American what was going on in the world in 1917, I think a lot of us would be at somewhat of a loss. So I want to put you in the year of her birth to see if we can't understand perhaps the world she found herself in as a young girl living in the heartland. In 1917, World War I was not only still raging, but it was at its zenith. By the time the dust settles in 1918 and that World War ends, over 20 million people will have died, many of whom were civilian casualties. Also, the Bolshevik Revolution is happening in Russia, right, which has a major impact on global politics. In fact, in some ways, the Cold War and many of our geopolitical discussions today are very much still rooted in that experience. Women did not have the right to vote in the United States, and it's not until 1920 when we ratify the 19th Amendment that women even have the right to vote. Racial segregation, lynching, and Jim Crow laws in the Deep South are very much our reality. This doesn't begin to be challenged until we get the landmark Brown versus Board of Ed case in 1954. Coincidentally, a nice trivia fact, Gwendolyn Brooks's mother was involved in that case. She came from a long line of activists. And so, we will find the Brooks family has their fingerprints on a lot of American history. And something else that is deeply disturbing, when we think about the legacy of lynching in this country, on average, 3 people of color were lynched a week in the Deep South from the 1880s till the 1930s. 3 human beings a week in these extrajudicial killings. And while the data is still lacking because many of these were not fully reported to authorities, we know definitively of at least 3,500 murders. That's more people than died on 9/11. And finally, the Great Migration is happening, which is this mass exodus. And in fact, it's the largest recorded movement of human beings in human history. Between 1900 and 1970, which are the broadest years that sociologists give us, over 6 million African Americans leave the Deep South, and the Brooks family was one of them. They are in Kansas, and they moved to Chicago looking for a better life. And as we look forward and we think about the poet that Brooks ultimately becomes, she is going to be publishing in the 1940s and 50s. Most of the publishing houses in this country are centered in New York, and they are run by white men who come from aristocratic backgrounds. And so when we think about what it might be to be a woman of color trying to publish her first book in your 20s or 30s in mid-century America, that in and of itself would have been a grand task indeed. Gwendolyn Brooks was born June 7th, 1917 in Topeka, Kansas. She lives there less than 2 months. The Brooks family is facing economic hardship. They are facing a lack of opportunity, and they relocate to Chicago. And I would be greatly remiss if I didn't say about a million times tonight that Gwendolyn Brooks was a proud Chicagoan, and her legacy is innately connected to the legacy of that city, and she is one of the great literary figures. In fact, they renamed a park just a few short years ago, Gwendolyn Brooks Park. I think it was Hyde Park before, but forgive me if I'm a little off on that. Her mother, Keziah, was a school teacher who was a classically trained pianist and gave local performances. Her father, David Brooks, was a somewhat of a tragic figure. He was remarkably literary, and he had aspirations of being a doctor, but because of the need to provide for his family and the struggle to make ends meet, he, most of his life, was a custodian, and he was never able to pursue his medical dream. However, both of her parents, even though neither one of them pursued writing, they were remarkably literary. They were well-versed in the writers of the Harlem Renaissance, and Brooks has memories as a very young child, being a toddler, of her parents reciting by memory the works of County Colon, Claude McKay, Langston Hughes. These are the major names of the Harlem Renaissance, black poets of the 20s and 30s. And at the age of 7, Brooks has said in many interviews throughout her life that she brought her mother, quote, a page of rhymes. And she never quite elaborated if it was the early timid verses of a child or if it quite was literally a page of rhymes. But what we do know is that her mother embraced that moment and applauded her daughter for that budding talent. And in some ways, the beginning of Brooks's career, I think, is the something of an origin story. By the time she was 13, Brooks had published her first poem, and by the time she was 16, a sophomore in high school, she had published over 70 poems. She was a total overachiever. I'm baffled by that kind of ambition. She was also, at that same time in high school, a regular contributor to the Chicago Defender, which was a prominent African-American newspaper. And so she was publishing quite regularly while most of us are still trying to, you know, solve for X or wondering who's going to go with us to the dance or do I look cute in these jeans or whatever questions, right, we're all consumed with in those early years of high school. Brooks was all business. And by the way, this image is of one of the many children's books she wrote. We'll talk about the many hats she wore here in a little while, but she was also a gifted children's author. Brooks met some resistance to her brilliance in high school. She, in fact, changed high schools 3 times. She attended a predominantly all-white high school, went to a predominantly all-black high school, and finding both of those experiences fairly traumatic, ended up at an integrated high school where she felt more at home. She was a shy girl. She had a devilish sense of humor that she mostly kept to herself. And she would remark later that she spent a lot of her time writing and reading, which both her teachers and her friends found strange. And some have remarked that she seemed socially awkward even later in life, but I would argue that she wasn't socially awkward at all. She was simply sort of exploring her own imagination. And I think the passion for writing, as we can clearly tell by that publication record, was already there. Brooks goes on to earn a bachelor's degree, an associate's degree at Wilson Junior College, and then decides to write full-time rather than going on to pursue advanced degrees. But a major turning point happens in her early 20s because she joins a local community writers group, and she is mentored by Inez Cunningham Stark, who at the time was something of a mover and shaker in the literary scene of Chicago. As somebody who does poetry for a living, though, I can tell you that Inez Cunningham Stark is all but forgotten today, and I'm not saying that to be dismissive of her legacy. I think she thought of herself as something of a poet, but
through the lens of history, we can see that her real gift was as a teacher and as a mentor. She also was a whiz with poetic forms. And one of the things she instilled in a young Brooks was that you have to have a mastery of tradition and a mastery of your craft if you're going to succeed and take this seriously. And so I think one of the reasons we see in Brooks's early books a love of rhyme, a mastery of meter, a kind of delicacy with the English sonnet is because of that mentorship from Stark. One of the other things that I think is important to understand about Brooks, there's another river that kind of flows into her sea, is that she actually had the opportunity, being part of the social network of Chicago, to meet some really prominent writers, slide a poem or two in front of them, and get their approval and validation. And so Langston Hughes and Richard Wright, two of the biggest names in American modern literature, who came out of the Harlem Renaissance, not only met her, but read her work and gave her encouragement. Although she said later in an interview that, quote, "I have a lot of admirations, but I don't want to sound like any of them." And I find that to be rather telling because it shows that even though she had a reverence for this older generation of writers, she was very much on her own path. After meeting as activists in the local NAACP, they were part of the youth council. Gwendolyn marries Henry Blakely Jr., and they remain married through the rest of their lives. They were deeply in love, and I think they also had a deep abiding respect and friendship, and they would go on to have two children, a son, Henry III, and a daughter, Nora, who coincidentally is not only still alive and well, but if you do any research on Gwendolyn Brooks, she is not only the literary executor of Brooks's estate, but she also runs Brooks's online social media presence, and she's very much involved in her mother's legacy. Brooks passed away in 2000, but Nora is very much doing whatever she can to keep the Brooks memory alive. Brooks publishes her first book, A Street in Bronzeville, in 1945, the very year that World War II ends. And this book is virtuosic. When we think about somebody's first book, particularly in the field of poetry, it's normally got fingerprints all over it. What I mean by that is it shows the influence of favorite writers. It shows the influence of poetry teachers. And I'm not saying that A Street in Bronzeville is free of all influence, but it shows a mastery of subject matter and form and voice that is fairly uncommon. And this really got the attention of national literary critics. And the landmark event that happens is in 1949 for her second book called Annie Allen, Brooks wins the Pulitzer Prize, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But I want to stress something real quick before we move on. Both The Street in Bronzeville and Annie Allen are deeply committed to exploring Black life. This is in a pre-civil rights America, and the idea that not only would a young African-American woman without advanced writing degrees, without New York literary connections, would have a major publishing house take on her work. She published with Harper and Row. But the fact that she was able to write about what she wanted to write about, Black families, Black communities, racism, institutional racism, the realities of poverty, this was serious subject matter. And that she had an audience and editors who believed in her is a testament to her genius and her talent. I want to dwell for a few minutes on the first of three poems I want to share with you by Brooks tonight. It is from her book, Annie Allen, her second collection, and it's a poem, well, it's a section of a poem, really, called The Children of the Poor. The Children of the Poor is a long poem that has five sections. They are all rigorous English sonnets. We would be here till midnight if we talked about all of them. So I'll just spend a few minutes on this one before we move on. But what I want us to see, just to preview this poem, is its interrogation of the subject matter, its direct confrontations with poverty, its almost Baroque love of language. We have some wild poetic diction, and when we think of diction, we think of word choice. And we have a social consciousness. This is a young poet who isn't doing any navel-gazing whatsoever. She's not writing about, oh, my love has done me wrong, or, you know, here's how I'm thinking and feeling. She's got her gaze turned outward, which I think is really, really mature. What shall I give my children who are poor, who are adjudged the least wise of the land, who are my sweetest lepers, who demand no velvet and no velvety velour, but who have begged me for a brisk contour, crying that they are quasi, contraband, because unfinished, graven by a hand less than angelic, admirable or sure. My hand is stuffed with mode, design, device. but I lack access to my proper stone. And plenitude of plans shall not suffice, nor grief, nor love shall be enough alone to ratify my little halves who bear across an autumn freezing everywhere. Brooks is responding to the poverty of Chicago and the duality of that city, its prosperity, its richness, its urban cultural flourishing, and yet the brute reality that so many African Americans in that city are struggling to make ends meet. Not only that, this poem has a really curious and slippery first-person voice. Is this Brooks herself? Because this sounds like a middle-aged person lamenting that they can't do enough to save the next generation, to save their children. I don't know if it is Brooks. Is it a community mother? Is it the voice of the people themselves? It's an eye that we haven't really seen in poetry, I would argue, since Walt Whitman, a kind of collective eye. The voice of the consciousness of the community itself. And so when we think of Whitman's Leaves of Grass and the ways in which he'd in some ways sort of take on America in the voice of America for America, here's Brooks in some ways taking on the voice of the people for the people by the people. The diction here is not merely wild, but full of kinetic energy. Look at line 2, adjudged. That is a verb that we do not encounter very often outside of a legal setting. And in fact, it is a legalese word. It means to be condemned. Also, lepers. We're getting biblical in line 3. The idea that poor children are unwanted, untouchable, filthy, contaminated, contagious. And as we go throughout, quasi and contraband complicates this discussion. To be quasi means to be partial, incomplete, and contraband means to be illicit, almost traded in secret, right? And as we move throughout the poem, we see a new metaphor emerge around lines 8 through 12, and it's the idea of the artist or the sculptor not being able to finish their own marvel, their own creation, because they have the tools, but they don't have the proper stone. There is something inadequate that will not let the vision emerge fully. And when we look at these children, who are, as the title suggests, the children of the poor, we see it is not because they are intrinsically flawed. It's because the people around them do not have the material necessities to help them become the wonders that they are, to love them and help them on their journey called life. This poem is an indictment of all of us. And it's an indictment of the hierarchical structures that prevent Black communities and Black parents from being able to provide for the children. It's also something that is a call to action that is saying, if we are Americans and we see children who are in need, what does it say about us that we acknowledge it and do nothing? This poem, along with many others, was part of one of the great 20th century volumes of poetry published in the United States. Annie Allen, published in 1949, Brooks' second book, wins the Pulitzer Prize in 1950, and this, in many ways, cements her place in American history, although I would argue her legacy is much richer than this mere achievement. She was the first African-American, and in particular, the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in anything. You know, we talk about her being the first to win in literature. She was the first to win in anything. And to win at the young age of 32 for a second book, for those of us who know how the Pulitzers and the Nobels go, they are typically late life awards, not merely for the thing recently done, but also for a life of achievement. And for it to be given to a young writer who is still at a stage of promise and emergence was a clarion call. It was a moment of transition. This book received rave reviews from the New York Times Book Review, the Saturday Review of Literature, and many other national publications. And I will share with you, and forgive me for being a little dramatic, but the story of her getting notification, I think, is worth making a moment or two for here in the talk. So we have to remember that it's 1950, and cell phones don't exist. And so nobody tagged you on Facebook or Twitter to tell you you've just won the Pulitzer Prize. And one of the things about the Pulitzer is that they are rather snarky about keeping the winners in the dark and making sure that no one in the press leaks this information until the day of the announcement. Even today, if you want to know who's about to win a Pulitzer, you have to live stream from the Pulitzer website itself. They don't, and so they very much kind of keep a tight, heavy lid on sort of these results. So you want to find out who's winning one, you have to watch in real time every spring when the news is announced. Brooks is at home, and the power in her house has been turned off because her and her husband, Henry, are deficient on the bill. He is working. She is raising the children. They are educated, hardworking Americans, and yet they are a few days behind on the electric, and they shut the power off. Younger Americans may not know this, but in most cases at this time in American history, that even if your electric was shut off, your phone would still work because you would be able to call 911 and it was a security thing. The phone rings in the quasi-darkness of her kitchen, and she answers it, and it's a reporter from a local Chicago newspaper, and he asks her, "How does it feel, Miss Brooks? You've just won the Pulitzer Prize in poetry." She thought she was being pranked. She didn't believe him. And after his earnest entreatments and his serious tone, and she realized he was telling the truth, she thanked him, and she said her first thought was, if reporters show up in the morning, they won't be able to plug their cameras in. They won't be able to use the electrical outlets in my home. My power's off. The first thing she felt after shock and surprise was not elation, but shame. And then she took her young son to the living room, and with no lights on and no way to play music, they danced as dusk fell through the blinds. And then she scrounged some pocket change while her husband was working a long shift, and they went to the movies and they caught a film together. It says something about the quality of greatness, but it also says that acclaim does not change things on the ground as quickly as one might think. I think there's a lot of other parables in that story. By the end of her career, Brooks bristled ever so gently at the idea of always being reminded that she won a Pulitzer at 32. In fact, she once said in an interview in 1994, towards the end of her life, that as she went on, quote, "there was often the feeling that there must be something wrong with you if you had acquired one of these gifts from the establishment." She took herself really seriously, and she took her activism and individuality really seriously. And the idea that she had been a young whippersnapper and now she was part of the establishment, I think that made her a little uneasy, right? She didn't want to be part of any establishment. She wanted to be herself. And she said in another interview in the early 90s, and this is rather delicious in its multiple meanings, she said that winning the Pulitzer was, quote, "a pleasant salute. It is a smile usually accepted." Boy, we could spend a lot of time parsing all the sort of subtleties of that. It's a smile usually accepted, huh? At some point, stop asking me, perhaps, is what she's saying. This takes us to her mid-career. And before we talk about a major transition that she went through at the age of 50, I want to take a few minutes to dwell on my second of three poems by Brooks tonight. And it is her most iconic poem. It's the poem that's in most of our college literary anthologies. And if you know anything about Brooks at all, perhaps you came in here tonight knowing we real cool. This eight-line poem is, in many ways, what she's remembered for. I'm slightly uncomfortable with that. Brooks herself, by the early 1980s, would preface it at public readings, some of which you can find online, poetryfoundation.org, poets.org, where she would introduce the poem and say, "I wish the editors would remember I wrote some other things too," as if she would almost kind of get a dig in before she would prepare to recite this brief piece. One of the things that I want to point out is that this is from a book called The Bean Eaters, which is a book-length project that explores poverty as a kind of social disease, as a problem that we can fight and overcome, but we lack the will and courage to do so. When we teach We Real Cool to high school and college students, we're taking out of its original context of a book-length project where all the poems overlap in subject matter and sometimes overlap in voices. She has these characters, you know, these characters in that book. It's in many ways kind of like a novel in verse. And so the older I get, the more uncomfortable I am with that by taking this out of its context, we in some ways are losing some of what we need in order to fully understand and fully come to terms with the poem. I'll read it briefly. "We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. Goodness, we've come a long way from that sonnet I read a few minutes ago. And yet, Brooks is still the same poet. She is able to slide in and out of free verse and in and out of traditional English forms with great grace and great range. She might be one of the rangiest poets of the 20th century, which is another reason to love her. She could do anything with language. When we look at this poem, the epigraph, oh goodness, my coffee's wearing off. The epigraph or note tucked under the title is really crucial, although perhaps that was a Freudian slip. It is in some ways a epitaph. The pool player, Seven at the Golden Shovel. When we take that into consideration with the poem, I think so much becomes clear. We are looking at seven young people, probably young men, probably young African-American men in Chicago, who are either playing hooky from high school or have dropped out. They are resisting authority, and they are playing pool, and they are being rapscallions, for lack of a better word. There is a lot of loaded language in here. We know that they're drinking alcohol, and they're trying to feel cool, but they're not hardened by life yet because they have to, quote, thin their gin. They're watering down their booze. So they might have been able to sneak in to where all the older men in their community hang out on a weekday, right? But they can't quite take their hooch yet. Also, they brag about things that grown men who are actually living in the streets would never brag about, right? I'm staying up late. I don't know any gangsters who say, I stay up late, right? We lurk late. We don't listen to our bedtimes anymore. And so, as a poem that I've taught many times over the years, I sometimes tell my students that this poem is about how it feels when you realize that the world is full of false authority and that the systems that are in place are hypocritical, and you have one foot in childhood and one foot in adulthood, and you belong in neither. And so you're rebelling for reasons that you cannot fully understand, but you're rebelling out of an emotional and psychological need to assert your independence. Of course, the irony in the poem, which didn't occur to me till much later in life when I was a college student, which shows I'm not a very sharp reader at all, is the fact that by rebelling, they're hanging out in a little clique, which in many ways is the opposite of rebellion. You know, if you're thumbing your nose at the establishment, or you're blowing off your high school teachers and parents because, quote, they just don't get you, and yet you've given over that old authority to a new authority, which is the school clique. And now you're just blindly following this charismatic group of friends who you want to prove your manliness to. And so we've thrown off one figure for another figure. This poem, coincidentally, was banned many times throughout American history in the 50s and 60s. Some critics, I think, let's just be real with each other. White traditionalists who resented Brooks's talent, who resented her fame and her Pulitzer, who maybe were hoping that she would publish something controversial that they could, you know, immediately say, this doesn't represent our literary values. At any rate, what I'm about to say takes a lot of straining, but here's the argument. The line, we jazz June, some, and I think this is a willful misreading, the notion was June capitalized rather than being the month was a girl's name, and by jazzing her, these seven boys are all flirtatious with the same young lady, or they all have amorous desires with the same young lady, or if we really want to stretch it as far as it'll go, they're all romancing this young lady, if I can put it that way. I think that's an intentional misreading of the poem. You know, the idea that you jazz June refers to the end of the school year in most public schools, right? It's when kids get jittery and antsy, and it's when their resistance to learning is at its zenith right before school gets out. The idea that they're jazzing June is, you know what, we couldn't make it to the end of the year, we're out of here, teach. And yet the fact that this got banned with a kind of absurd sexual innuendo, which I would argue really isn't here at all, says something about the readership of the times. Brooks goes through something of a personal transformation, perhaps is the best way to put it, at age 50. In 1967, she attended the second Black Writers Conference at Fisk University, one of our great HBCUs. And it's there that she was, I think she was expecting just to be welcomed as a senior voice or as a, you know, mature poet. And she was kind of blasted by all the young writers there who took her to task for not being radical enough. But here's the thing that I want to emphasize. Brooks was already quite active and quite socially conscious and had put writing about the black community as her chief objective as a poet. So it says something about the times that she was criticized by her young counterparts, mostly poets in their early 20s, for not shaking things up more than she was. Among these young writers were Haki Madhubuti and Amiri Baraka, formerly Leroy Jones, among several others. Don L. Lee was another. And it's at this point that she goes through something of, she does some soul searching, and she really finds herself becoming an adherent to a doctrine of thought we call black nationalism, which I like to quote Ron Karenga, another great writer of this era, and his definition of black nationalism was, quote, the fact that we are black is our ultimate reality. And while this has been mischaracterized a lot of times in the past half century, black nationalism was not black separatism. It certainly wasn't this idea that African Americans should withdraw from mainstream society, but rather the idea that black communities should be self-sufficient, should be motivated by pride and a sense of history, and that when the establishment was not interested in promoting black literature and black arts, that folks within the movement should take it upon themselves to found their own presses, create their own theaters, and create the space for their own art. In many ways, this comes out of, I think, a lot of the movements of the late 60s and early 70s that have a very DIY aesthetic, right? You know, this idea of do it yourself. If the publishers don't want us, stop knocking on the door. Let's become the publisher. If the theaters don't want our plays, let's become the theater. If the record labels don't want our songs, let's create our own label. And I think that spirit is very much in a lot of the social change of the time. Brooks, more than any other period in her career, there has been a lot of scholarship and literary criticism about this moment. I want to be careful and say that I'm not a Brooks biographer, and I don't have an angle here. Some have argued that she broke with her past self and with her past writing. I find that to be a little extreme and not in keeping with my sense of who she was. Others have argued that she didn't really change at all. She just sort of was jostled by these young people. I find that to be an oversimplification too. I find myself somewhere in the middle that if anything, she was re-energized. And she saw that in order for her poetry to stay relevant to an America where in less than 5 years, think about what is happening on her watch. President Kennedy is assassinated in 63. Dr. King and Malcolm X are assassinated within 3 short years. Malcolm X in 1965, Dr. King in 1968. And we have our growing involvement in the war in Vietnam, which is profoundly unpopular. I think these young people perhaps got her to see the enormity of what was at stake. Not that she wasn't aware, but perhaps she thought that she had had done all she could. And I think this moment was something of a catalyst. When we think about her career as a whole, I had to abridge greatly her list of achievements because we could talk about her awards and her recognitions for a very long time indeed. 1946, she was a Guggenheim Fellow. In 1950, as I've noted already, she won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. In 1976, she won the prestigious Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Foundation. In 1985, she became consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. That's a really clunky phrase. In fact, we've renamed the role. We've named the role Poet Laureate of the United States of America. She was the first woman of color to hold that position, and she served a 1-year term. In 1989, she won the prestigious Robert Frost Medal for Lifetime Achievement. In 1995, she won a National Medal for the Arts. In 1997, this lifelong and proud Chicagoan received the Order of Lincoln, which is the highest honor a citizen can receive as a resident of the state of Illinois. And in 2012, 2 years after her passing, she was commemorated with a U.S. Forever postage stamp. Perhaps you saw this at the post office a decade ago when you went to mail, you know, somebody a birthday card. She also served as Poet Laureate of the state of Illinois for 32 years. As someone who makes poetry his life's work, I can tell you that laureateships typically last 1 or 2 years. And if somebody is doing an exceptional job, they might serve a second term, although that's somewhat uncommon. I know of no other poet that I've encountered who served as poet laureate of anything for 32 years. If that doesn't say something about Gwendolyn Brooks, her love of Chicago, and what her state meant to her and what she meant to her state, I don't know what does. It's just an incredible service role that was largely uncompensated, that had her doing a lot of public speaking and a lot of youth outreach. it was probably nice on paper, but thankless in reality. And she gave that for three decades. The third and final poem I want to share with you by Gwendolyn Brooks is from rather late in her career. She passed in the year 2000. And in the 1980s and 1990s, her output, having been rather prolific throughout much of her career, slowed. Which is not to be dismissive of her late work. It's just, you know, she was not publishing at the same rate as she did earlier in her career. We also find her turning increasingly towards free verse in the end years as well. And this is one of her most famous final poems, and it's called Two Black Women. And I think this poem functions as both an ode, which is a tradition in poetry, a praise poem. An ode is a song of praise or a poem of praise. So there's a sense of jubilation and hope and uplift in an ode. We think of Keats's great odes as he was sick. But I think it also serves as a kind of epistolary poem, what we'd call in poetry an apostrophe, a direct address. That two in the title is speaking to not a general audience, but a specific audience, to black women. Sisters, where there is cold silence, no alleluias, no hurrahs at all, no handshakes, no neon red or blue, no smiling faces, prevail. Prevail across the editors of the world who are obsessed, self-honeying and self-crowned in the seduced arena. It has been a hard trudge with fainting, bandaging, and death. There have been startling confrontations. There have been tramplings of monarchs and of other men. But there remains large countries in your eyes, shrewd sun, the civil balance, the listening secrets, and you create and train your flowers still. The poem is rich in its language and in its celebration of black femininity and in its gritty message of hope and of self-preservation. When we look at line three, which is really where I feel like the poem descends into itself, no alleluias, no hurrahs, no handshakes. It's curious that the lovely H alliteration represents in some ways three different spheres of life. The alleluia is the church call. The hurrah is the crowd or the street call, the call of the sporting game. And the handshake is the sign of business and of politics. When none of them have your back, my sisters, Brooks seems to be saying, believe in yourself and believe in each other, right? When the church lets you down, your faith lets you down, your community, your town, your village, the people at the concert let you down. And when the handshake is false, when the politician is a phony or the business deal is going to be done wrong, you have to find a way to believe and keep moving on. And forgive me that if in line four, when I see no neon red or blue, and of course that seems to just be a reference to maybe, you know, signs and business, a continuation of the handshake reference. It's 2020. We're in election year, right? No red, no blue. I don't want to make too much of this, but it would seem that she's also sort of insinuating this is not ancient history. It's 81. Those colors were associated with political parties then too. And it seems to be saying, and when nobody in the public sphere and no one in the political arena seems to really care about what it means to be a black woman, you have to find a way to keep going. The second stanza, in its gritty repetitions of trudge and trampling, and we get those hard T sounds that are grating and raw, it seems to be a reference to history. Not merely the slave experience in the Middle Passage, but there's also sort of a nod to the Trail of Tears as well. This idea that the journey isn't over, it's been arduous, and the gains of it are seemingly dismal. How do we keep going when there aren't signposts of progress? And that is answered very much in the final lines. And this poem functions sort of like a very rhetorically. This poem, in some ways, much like Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, is a Jeremiad, you know, sort of has a three-step sort of rhetoric to it. And she says, the reason we have to keep going is that there are, quote, large countries in your eyes. You are a country. You are as deep as a country. You are full of story and love and talent. Don't squander that. Even if the people around you can't see your potential or see the grace that you can offer. And that line, as well as that gorgeous last line of blossoming and of rebirth and of resurrection, It's curious that in this free verse poem that is rather colloquial and rather plain in its language, despite how much I love all the sonic qualities here, I've talked about alliteration twice already, she has two lines towards the end where she almost can't resist breaking into meter. And I would point out that, but there remain large countries in your eyes, forgive my sing-songy tone, but it's the teacher in me, and you create and train your flowers still. At the end, not just of her career, but at the end of this poem, she has not forgotten that sometimes you need to break into iambs. Sometimes you need to break into ancient music to lift people up. And there at the end of this free verse poem, she ends in meter. She ends with two lines of iambic pentameter. Much like so much of her work, uniting these different aspects within herself and different aspects of her talent and different aspects of her poetic ability. When we look at Gwendolyn Brooks, the themes that she wrote about are unbelievably resonant for our times. And I would argue, as cliche as it might sound, that Brooks in some ways is more relevant in 2020 than she was in the 1940s and 50s when she began her poetic journey. When we look at these themes, and I'll prattle through them very quickly, but we see that she is writing about the real struggles of real Americans. First and foremost, she is writing about blackness. She's writing what it means to struggle, what it means to come to terms with your history, and what it means to live in a country that does not fully embrace your humanity, your culture, your story. She said at one point in her career that she was trying to, quote, make a banner of blackness. And what a beautiful turn of phrase that is. A banner, an emblem, something to hold and march with and be proud of, something to stand under and to hope. And she also said in one of her interviews, quote, has any oppressed and repressed group endured outrage without a yip forever? And I would say her poems were much bolder than mere yips, but that idea that sometimes we have to wallow and wade through discomfort if we are serious about enacting change. And I think she is a symbol of that, that sometimes we have to have the hard conversations in order to seek solutions. She looked at poverty, particularly its impact on families and children. She looked at the inner lives of African Americans. She is the first writer that I can think of in American history, not in poetry, not in the 20th century, in American history, who is writing about the interior lives of urban black women. The only real writer of significance to write about black women in any kind of way before her would be Zora Neale Hurston. Of course, the mother of American poetry after Anne Bradstreet is Phyllis Wheatley, the first African-American woman to publish a book of poems. But if we think about Miss Wheatley writing in colonial America at age 19, she's not really writing about the black experience. She's writing about traditional mythological and religious themes because that's all she can get published. She lived in different times. Who knows what Miss Wheatley would have done. But after Zora Neale Hurston, we have Gwendolyn Brooks really dignifying the black female experience. And she's the first person to write about how that experience is complicated by and made all the more fraught by city life after the Great Migration in America's urban centers. She wrote about how family is not so much a celebration of tradition, but that family is where we can be ourselves. We can be individuals and we can find intimacy and support. She wrote passionately that the political is personal and the personal is political, and that we can't separate these two spheres of existence. We can't say I'm one person at home and I'm someplace else in the street and I'm someplace else, somebody else at my job. We have to be whole persons, and being whole persons is a lot harder. And finally, she wrote about the necessity of being involved in your community. She wrote about children and their innocence and how we as adults squander that innocence through our own failures and cowardice, and that we must look at our history if we're ever to overcome it. When Gwendolyn Brooks passed at the age of 83 in 2000, she had left us an incredible, incredible legacy. She had written over 17 books of prose and poetry. She edited two others of young poets, I should add, that's not here on the slide. And she taught at a half dozen various institutions, including the University of Chicago and Columbia. She also taught at Columbia College Chicago, some other great institutions. Today, a half dozen public schools in the state of Illinois bear her name, as does a literary center at Western Illinois University, and of course, Gwendolyn Brooks Park in Chicago. 3 years ago in 2017, those of us in the poetry community, at least the ones who were with it, had the Brooks Centennial, where there was a reinvigoration of her legacy, and at the major AWP conference, there was a panel that celebrated her life and work. And if you look at the family tree of American poets, if we were to talk about the great poets writing today, most of them are African-American. I would argue that. That's an opinion, but I'm just going to say it. But also, almost all of them in print have acknowledged that Brooks was a major influence on them. Rita Dove, Natasha Trethewey, Terrence Hayes, Evie Shockey, Nikki Finney, Elizabeth Alexander, Gregory Pardo, Honoré Jeffers, Toy Derricotte, and Tracy K. Smith. We have numerous Pulitzer winners, our current U.S. Poet Laureate in Tracy K. Smith, our former Poets Laureate, Rita Dove and Natasha Trethewey. This is a great starting point if we're to think about why poetry matters in the 21st century. Brooks is there. I want to end with just some final comments and final thoughts. Toy Derricotte is a great contemporary poet, and this is a poem that is an homage to Brooks. I don't want to analyze it, but I just want to read it because I think it's a beautiful painting, a word painting, that honors Brooks's influence and compassion and maternal nurturing of younger generations. And it's on the back of the handout that you have. It's called After the Gwendolyn Brooks Reading. She sits at the book signing table with a colorful African wrap tied around her head. She may have her chin in her palm, elbow on the table, as if resting her brain, that silvery jello in its luminous oyster shell, as she listens intently to each one of the churchwomen who have come on a bus in large church hats. They squawk with joy as they hand her bedraggled books taken down from their most honored shelves. And she, who conceived of Maud Martha, that woman who, by sparing a kitchen mouth, discovered unfurling her own great wings of compassion, talks to each one, letting them take as many pictures as they like, sandwiched between them, small, dignified, and perfectly at ease. Rather regal poem, isn't it? You can almost see her perched at the table as the readers ask for her signature. Forgive me for being somewhat indelicate, but I want to just offer, as I'm winding down here, an observation that I think is something that we all as readers and just as literary citizens should be aware of. There has never been an authoritative volume of Gwendolyn Brooks's collected poems. She's been gone for 20 years, and we do not have a chronological gathering of her life's work. For someone who is in poetry and publishing, I can tell you that this is a glaring omission and something that needs to be rectified, and I hope to see it rectified in my lifetime. In recent years, when we think about great poets passing, I think of Lucille Clifton, the great Maryland poet who passed a few years ago. When we think of other great American poets like Robert Lowell, there is a tradition in American literature that within a few years of someone's passing, we collect their work as a final document and we offer it to the reading public in a handsome volume for $20 or $30. And it should be on Barnes and Noble shelves and all other book retailers. And that way, if you want to get somebody's best, you can buy what is called their selected poems. But if you really want the full story, and for those of us who are poetry nerds, we want the full story, the collected poems is the, you know, the final testament. This has never existed, and there's no plans for it to exist. Part of this has to do with Brooks's publishing history. Her first five books came out with Harper & Row, a prestigious New York publisher. In the late 60s, as you may recall from a few slides ago, she had a reinvigoration of her Black identity and her commitment to Black art. She gave the remainder of her life and the remainder of her work to small, independent Black publishers, two of them being Broadside Press and Third World Press. Both of these presses suffered from less than ideal production values. They both suffered from distribution problems. They both suffered with financial solvency. And in many ways, this reduced Brooks's audience. Let me be clear. I am in no way slighting African-American presses or presses committed to people of color. I am saying something specifically about these two presses and that they worked to attract a major writer and then did not uphold their end of the bargain to honor that great writer. That's the narrow comment I'm trying to make. The literary critic Craig Werner once said rather boldly and directly, quote, "These presses suffered from distribution problems, which rendered her late work largely invisible to the American reading public." And that's borne out because if you seek her work later tonight or over the weekend as you're thinking about her, the vast majority of her work is out of print. We are talking about a major, major voice, and most of her work is out of print. In 1994, Third World Press published and he holds it up for the audience to see. Her book, Blacks, which is something approximating a collected poems, but it wasn't a collected poems. It does capture much of her early work. It's spotty on the second half of her career, and as somebody who is a bibliophile, I'm somewhat critical of this volume, not because of its rather understated cover, but because it has typos and major shifts in font, which is copy editing 101, right? We shouldn't let that happen to a great writer. And it's now out of print. Perhaps during the Q&A we can talk about how you can find her work. But, you know, I dream of a world in which Gwendolyn Brooks' poems are back on bookshelves, easy to find, and affordable. Some final wisdom I'd like to leave you with. I've tried to weave in Brooks' voice into this talk, because that's what this is really about. It's about how her poems tell her story, and how her story is an integral part of our America. Three things, or pearls of wisdom, that she said that have really stayed with me in recent weeks as I've thought about meeting you this evening, and that I hope that we can all carry forward. The first is, quote, the best thing you can do for a writer is keep them from starving. And, you know, this is, you know, for all of her acclaim, I think it probably took a really long time for Gwendolyn Brooks to get to a place of, you know, financial comfort. And, you know, we sometimes have this mistaken notion that having several books published or having won a few big awards that you've quote unquote made it. And it's simply not the truth. She had to pay the light bill like everybody else. And I think it's something else I'll say that is related to this, but this is sort of a shameless plug because, after all, we are at Warwick Community College. Brooks was brilliant and gifted and one of the great minds of her times, and she never went beyond a 2-year degree. So see what you can do in the world with a 2-year degree? Start here, go anywhere? Okay, that's the advertisement. But perhaps a more serious quote, something of a mantra, was she once said, quote, it is my privilege to present Negroes, African Americans, not as curios, but as people. And to finally be done with old stereotypes, to finally be done with old notions, and say, what does it mean to be black in America? Which is the central question to her life's work. And I think the secondary question is, are we telling that story, and do we care? And finally, I want to end with the closing lines of one of her very last poems, which is a tribute and homage to Paul Robeson, the great performer, activist, you may know him. But this is a poem about him, but at the end of the poem, her gaze widens, and it becomes something of, I just think, a statement of what she was about, and perhaps there are lines that you can carry with you. She said, quote, we are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond. Thank you very much.
As Adam indicated in his excellent presentation, Gwendolyn Brooks' work is mostly unread today. This is despite the fact that her social poetry of poverty and her exploration of black identity are extremely contemporary. Our thanks to Adam Tavel for bringing her work to light in his excellent talk. Next Thursday, Holly Karapetkova, chair of the Literature and Languages Department at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia, will discuss the poetry of witness. Her talk is particularly relevant today, given the recent conviction of Harvey Weinstein. Even though Holly doesn't mention the Weinstein trial, her discussion of witness will help all of us better understand the bravery and the mental price paid by the women who stepped forward to bear witness against him. Tune in next Thursday at 9 a.m. to Delmarva Public Radio's celebration of National Poetry Month to hear Holly Karapetkova on the poetry of witness. This program is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. I'm your host, Harold Wilson, and thanks to all of you for listening.